We are continuing with the story of Sodom, and we've gotten to chapter 19, I believe, which is when the angels continue on to after coming to Abraham. They've already announced the birth of Isaac. Abraham and God have had a dialogue about the destruction of the city, in which Abraham utters that quite remarkable line, "Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice?" Where he demonstrates a certain moral autonomy, where his sense of what is right is distinct from or overrides what might be his fear of God or his sense of God's judgment. There is, by the way, an interesting, we don't have to spend much time on this, but there's an interesting philosophical question here, which is, are things right because God wants them, or does God want them because things are right? Which is a question that is much discussed by religious philosophers. If you think about it, if things are right because God wants them, that is, whatever God wants is automatically right, then if God really wants to destroy Sodom, it must be right, okay? But if on the other hand, things are right and that's why God wants them, that means that there's a realm of right that is antecedent to, before, or separate from God. And there's just a world of moral right out there that has nothing to do with what God wants or who God is. There's just rightness. And God says, I want this because things are already right. So that's an interesting question, to which I don't obviously have a quick answer or even a long one. But it is, I don't have any, the easy answer, although this isn't so easy, is that the two are always congruent. They're always the same. What God wants is always what is right. But that doesn't really answer the question, because you could still ask, well, if there was no God, or if God didn't want it, would there still be this world of right? So Abraham, all of this by way of saying that Abraham clearly must believe that either God was testing him, which makes him very cynical in a way. You know, it's like, okay, I know God's testing me, so I better say something about Sodom. Or that there is a world of right independent of what God wants, which is an interesting question. So, for what it's worth. Okay. Chapter 19. The two angels arrived in Sodom in the evening as Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. First of all, let's take a look at 18:1 as we look at this. Notice, when Abraham is sitting in the gate, what does he see? He sees God and they become angels. Lot starts off just seeing angels. So already the text is hinting that there's a difference in the perception of Lot and Abraham, right? They don't see things the same way. Second, it says, when Lot saw them, he rose to greet them and bowing with his face to the ground said, please, my servants, turn aside. What does Abraham do? Looking up, he saw three men standing near him. As soon as he saw them, he ran from the entrance of the tent to greet them and bowing to the ground said, my lords, if it please you, don't go past your servants. So Lot stands up, Abraham runs. So also there's a contrast in the alacrity, in the speed, in the haste with which Abraham greets the guests. He says, look at verse 3. But he urged them strongly, so they turned his way and entered his house. He prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. So some commentators say, what is a feast for Lot? Unleavened bread. Big deal, right? But Abraham, remember, he makes cakes. He slaughters, a sheep, I believe. He gives them whey. He gives them milk and all that stuff. So there is apparently, while Lot still is observing the laws of hospitality, and of course most of the commentators say, why is Lot hospitable? Because he grew up with Abraham, right? They still want to give the credit to Abraham. There's an attempt to not give any credit whatsoever to Lot here. But still, between the two, it does seem that he is that Abraham is the more hospitable.
And are they alluding to the fact that Lot is already influenced by his environment?
Yes, and in fact, that is a perfect lead-in about Lot being influenced by his environment to what it says, where is it? In verse 2. Now this will show you, again, remember that the rabbis lived at a time, and the medieval commentators too, where there were minimal distractions, and they lived in the text, and the text was, they soaked themselves in it. They knew it so well that here is something that none of us, I think, would notice, but is in almost all the commentaries. It says, he said, please, my lords, turn aside to your servant's house to spend the night and bathe your feet that you may be on your way early. Okay? Now, look back at 13:2, which you probably haven't been thinking about. 13:12, I'm sorry, 13:12. And tell me what it is they're picking up on. 13:12, the verse says, Abram remained in the land of Canaan while Lot settled in the cities of the plain, pitching his tents near Sodom. That's when they first divide the land. Okay, once again. Abram remained in the land of Canaan while Lot settled in the cities of the plain, pitching his tents near Sodom. And now it says, please, my lord, turn aside to your servant's house to spend the night and bathe your feet that you may be on your way early. No, it's a good guess, but it's more subtle than that, or more obvious, depending on. No, it has nothing to do with Lot's actions.
Random.
You're looking for two nouns, two contrasting nouns. No, although cities is a good guess. Want me to tell you? He pitched his tent, but now he lives in a house. It's one thing to live near Sodom to pitch your tent because you're staking out some land. But once you're living in a house in a community, you're part of that community. He's not living on the periphery of Sodom in a tent as he was in 13:12. A change has happened in Lot's life, but the change is so subtle that unless you read the text very carefully, you won't see it. Now Lot is really part of the community. We all know, and it was probably no different in ancient Sodom, when you buy a house in a community, you're committing to that community, to the schools, to the kids, you know, to the friends. I mean, that's what it is when you buy a house. And now Lot has a house in Sodom, which already lets us know, if we're attentive enough to the text, that we can expect from Lot some of the behavior of what the rabbis call Midat Sodom, right? Midat Sodom means the way of the Sodomites, the way the people in Sodom do their business. Midat Sodom in the rabbis, and we'll talk more about this next time or the time after, Midat Sodom in the rabbis is, the rabbis talk about that there are different ways of relating. The average person says, what's mine is mine, what's yours is yours. The saintly person says, what's yours is yours, what's mine is yours. And Midat Sodom is, what's yours is mine, and what's mine is mine. So that's Midat Sodom, okay? Also known as, you know, rapacious capitalism. Okay, not really, but sort of. And it's important that the rabbis are actually saying this as a personal Midah, not as a societal suggestion. I mean, there are lots of civil laws and economic laws in Jewish tradition. None of them say that everybody should give up everything they own. As a human race, we've tried that, and it doesn't work very well. Okay, so they say to him, "No, we'll spend the night in the square." So they are, first of all, now this may be formulaic. You know, when someone offers you hospitality, you say, "No, it's all right." You know. Just like a grandmother. No, I'll sleep on the couch. It's the kids don't have to give up their room. It's okay. So angels are like that. They have that same accent and everything. But he urged them strongly, so they turned his way and entered his house. He prepared a feast for them and baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Again, the same question of how do angels really eat? It could be that they're faking eating. It could be that actually that's the only option traditionally, or that in fact they're human beings and just acting in an angelic capacity. Okay. With us so far. Now, they hadn't yet lain down when the townspeople, the men of Sodom, young and old, all the people to the last man gathered about the house. So first of all, remember last time we were talking about, well, how is it that God can destroy the whole city, kids and adults? The corruption starts young, okay? Which is a good time for me to advertise my sermon this Shabbat. I'm talking about proms and after parties. The corruption starts young. That could be the subtitle of the sermon. If there's somebody that you think needs that, or if you're clashing with your kids, please bring them. So here too, obviously, if you're raised by corrupt parents and a corrupt community, then you know you're not. Then the likelihood that you will be good is much smaller. And they all gather around the house. They gather around the house probably because there are strangers there, maybe because the strangers look affluent. We'll come to the motivations in a minute. Okay. They shouted to Lot and said to him, "Where are the men that came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may be intimate with them." Now, intimate with them is v'neda otam, okay? V'neda otam, you know, yada, yodea is sexual in the Bible. But I just want to say, even though I think it probably is sexual, and almost everybody thinks that it's sexual, it doesn't absolutely have to be. I mean, it is conceivable that they want other, you know, they want to loot what their stuff, or they want to beat them up, or so on. I mean, this is where the English sodomizing comes from, for homosexual intercourse, right? It comes from this passage. And that's the prevailing assumption, is that that's what the sodomites are looking for. But the Bible doesn't get that explicit, and it doesn't say. In fact, when it says earlier, notice in verse 2, when it says, "Please, my lords, turn aside to your servant's house to spend the night and bathe your feet, and you may be on your way early." Right? How does he know they want to be on their way early? According to Abravanel, he wanted them to be on their way early because he didn't want anybody to see them. Right? So he said, you know, "Come on in, come into my house, don't stay outside, I'll hide you, I'll keep you here, and you'll leave under cover of darkness before everybody sees that I've got guests in my house." Because Lot knows, and this shows that he retains, if you follow this line of interpretation, he retains some of the humanity of growing up in Abraham's house. You know, he wants to protect them. They are after all, guests, and we all know that the ideal of hospitality is a very powerful one in traditional societies in general, and especially in the Middle East. So Lot went out to the entrance and shut the door behind him. So Lot goes out to speak to them. When it says that the men of the Anshei Sodom came, the men of Sodom, there may also be a play on the idea that these angels are men and the difference in men. I mean, there are men and there are men. You know, there are men that act like angels, and then there are men that act like the people of Sodom. It's possible. Okay. They shouted to him and said, "Who are the men? Bring us out that we be intimate." He shuts the door behind him and says, "I beg you, my friends, don't commit such a wrong. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you may do to them as you please, but don't do anything to these men since they've come under my roof." Okay, now this is a much discussed passage. I do. And by the way, is often, well, there are a couple of things. First of all, some people just say the most common interpretation of this is, the most common joint interpretation is that, first of all, Lot thinks, you know, hospitality, you have to do anything to save your guests because they're your guests. And if someone comes to your house and says, I want to injure somebody whom you've given shelter to, then you have to do whatever is possible to save them. The other line of interpretation is that this shows that Lot has lived in Sodom, right? Because it's clear that what he's doing is terrible, and the fact that he assumes that you can do this shows the influence of living in a bad neighborhood. I mean, the rabbis talk a lot about the influence of your peers. You know, this the woman Judith Harris, who wrote a book several years ago, and she actually just wrote a new one that I read a review of, but she wrote a book several years ago talking about the fact that your peers have a greater influence than your parents do on your conduct. You know, I remember the one example that I remember struck me, and I've repeated it before, just it's such a powerful example, is she says, that's why not only you dress like your peers and you listen to the music of your peers, not your parents' music by and large, but your peers, and you dress like them and you like their books and their movies and so on. She says, but also children of immigrants who learn to speak the language from their parents, after all, as we all do, don't speak with an accent. They speak like their peers, not like their parents. And that makes sense in an evolutionary way, because after all, in order to succeed in this world, you really only have to please your parents for a limited time. After that, you've got to be successful with your peers, right? So it's for most people, it's not ultimately your parents who are going to make your success in this world. After a certain amount of time, it's your peers. So we are geared to be able to live with our peers, which is why where you live and your peers have such a profound effect on who you become. So this also echoes a story, or is echoed in a story, in Judges chapter 19, which I will, you don't have to look, but this, and I won't read you the whole story, it's fairly long, but, it's a very painful story, but it has echoes and says something about, this is a part of the Bible that people, since most people don't read Judges, you may not be aware that the Bible contains stories like this, but it does. But the man refused to stay for the night. He set out and traveled as far as the vicinity of Yevus, that is Jerusalem. And he had with him a pair of donkeys and his concubine. Since they were close to Yevus and the day was very far spent, the attendant said to his master, "Let's turn aside to the city of the Jebusites." This is what Jerusalem was called before it was conquered and renamed Jerusalem. "And spend the night in it." But his master said, "We won't turn aside to a town of aliens who are not of Israel. Let's continue to Gibeah." "Come," he said, "let's approach one of those places and spend the night either in Gibeah or Ramah." So they traveled on, and the sun set where they were near Gibeah of Benjamin. They turned off there and went in to spend the night in Gibeah. He went and sat down in the town square, but nobody took them indoors to spend the night. In the evening, an old man came along from his property outside the town. The man hailed from the hill country. He happened to see the wayfarer. Where are you from, and where are you going to? He said, "We're traveling from Benjamin in Judah to the other end of the hill country of Ephraim. That's where I live. I made a journey, and now I'm on my way to the house of the Lord, and nobody's taken me indoors. We both have straw and feed for our donkeys and bread and wine for me and your handmaid and for the attendant with your servants. We lack nothing." "Rest easy," said the old man. "Let me take care of all your needs. Don't spend the night in the square." And he took him into his house. They fed everyone, including the animals. While they were enjoying themselves, the men of the town, a depraved lot, gathered about the house and were pounding on the door. They called to the aged owner of the house, "Bring out the man who's come to your house so that we can be intimate with him." And the words there is v'neida enu, which is the exact same root. The owner of the house went out and said to them, "Please, my friends, don't commit such a wrong. Since this man has entered my house, don't perpetrate this outrage. Look, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out to you. Have your pleasure of them. Do what you like, but don't do this outrageous thing to this man." But the men wouldn't listen to him, so the man seized his concubine and pushed her out to them. They raped her and abused her all night till morning and let her go when the dawn broke. Toward morning, the women came back as it was growing light, and she collapsed at the entrance of the man's house where her husband was. When her husband arose in the morning, he opened the doors of the house and went out to continue his journey. And there was the woman, his concubine, lying at the entrance of her house with her hands on the threshold. "Get up," he said, "let us go," but there was no reply. So the man placed her on his donkey and set out for home. When he came home, he picked up a knife, held his concubine and you should excuse me, but this is in the Bible, cut her limb from limb to 12 parts. She had obviously already died. He sent them throughout the territory of Israel, and everyone who saw it cried out, never has such a thing happened or been seen from the day the Israelites came out of Egypt till now. Put your mind to it, take counsel, and decide, and then it starts a war. Okay? Now, you can see from this story that later reading of this story influences the way people read the story of Sodom and what the Sodomites were really after and about, okay? And it also tells you, in a way, at first glance, this is a terrible story about ancient Israel. But at second glance, it's actually a beautiful story. Because remember what it says at the end. When he sends this to the 12 tribes of Israel, how do they react? Something like this has never happened in Israel from Exodus till now. In other words, this is an unprecedented outrage. And in fact, it leads, as I said, to this battle afterwards. So when we read this back into Sodom, we're supposed to feel like this is, and it's reinforced by the story of Judges, this is profoundly un-Israelite. And no Israelite would ever consider such a thing. And what they want to do, obviously, is comparable to what happens to that concubine. Now, as you will see, if you don't already know, it doesn't happen to the angels, because the angels, and to Lot's daughters, because the angels take action. But I think we're supposed to read this story in light of what happens later and know that the men of Sodom were going to do terrible things. Okay? Yeah.
Where the people in Sodom, were they Jewish?
No.
So they were not?
No. But the others were in Givah, in Judges, they were. No, the Sodomites are Sodomites. No, they're Sodom. They're not. There are no Jews. Remember, there's only Abraham and his household, right? So that's why I said the whole point is that nothing like this would happen in Israel. And the one time that it does, it's an unprecedented outrage many, many years later. Don't forget the Judges. The period of the Judges is before David, but it's 400 years after Abraham, depending, 500 years after, 400 probably, yeah. By Lot? Oh, no, not at all. No, not nobody thinks, nobody, you won't find anybody who thinks Lot's a good guy, right? There is no pro-Lot party for obvious reasons. And you'll see even afterwards.
Yeah, I was going to say, the story goes
Lot, he doesn't get better. Let me put it that way, okay? The part of the question is, why does he get saved? And it may be that he only gets saved because he's related to Abraham. Or it might be, I mean, this is what one commentator says, and I think, do I have the, he says something, I don't remember, he puts it well, but I don't have the exact, nonetheless, he says, look, if you see what Lot is like and he gets saved, that tells you what the sin of Sodom was like. Because you wonder, how could God destroy a whole city? And the answer is, look at the guy he saved, right? The guy he saved was willing to sacrifice his daughters. And later on, you'll see, commits incest with his daughters. Yeah.
So. It's also following the tradition of Abraham, who offers his wife.
Yeah, but he doesn't offer his wife to be raped, right? He offers his wife to be the wife of a king, which is, granted, I'm not saying that it's admirable, although we talked about that, and it's an interesting contrast to make. But of the two, it's the more, and also he asks her, he says to her, would you say you are my sister to save our lives? But the motivation may be the same. It may be that Lot thinks the only way to save the life of this family is to push the daughters out. I mean, if you want to make a pro-Lot argument, that's what you have to say. You have to say, are you given the standards of the time permitted to do this if they will end up raping everybody in the house anyway? And this will save them. And this question, by the way, which is much discussed in Jewish law, and there's a long series of very interesting essays and counter essays that I used to teach when I taught a class in Jewish ethics at the UJ years ago. And we traced this argument through the sources in the Jewish tradition of the question of a siege of a city. You know, and if they say, throw out this person, or will destroy the whole city, are you allowed to throw out the person, or are you not? And the general consensus in Jewish law seems to be If I say to you, I'm going to kill this entire class if you don't give me Francine Weiss, that they're allowed to give me Francine Weiss. But if I say to you, I'm going to kill this entire class unless you give me someone, you're not allowed to give me someone. You can't choose somebody to die in order to save yourselves. But if I say, I'm going to kill all of you, including Francine Weiss, unless you give me Francine Weiss, then you can give me Francine Weiss to save the city. That's the general consensus. But as you can imagine, this is, not only is this a very hard question, but this is actually a question that Jewish communities faced. They really did. So if they said, we will spare your house if you give us your daughter, you could make a good case. But if they said, we want your guests, you're not allowed to say, how about my daughters? You know, which is what he does. Okay. So where are we? Yes. Richard Elliot Friedman, who wrote an interesting commentary to the Torah and has a lot of really interesting things to say, is different from many commentators of the Torah because he's a modern biblical critical scholar who studies the civilizations around Israel, right? Sumer, Akkadian civilization, and so on. One of the things that enriches modern biblical study is that we didn't know until recently what these societies were like. It's only in the 19th and 20th century that we found these huge treasure troves of documents that all of a sudden tell us what the other societies around Israel were like, what they did, what they said, all that sort of thing. He says he doesn't really think that Lot meant this literally. He thinks this is ancient Near Eastern bargaining. And you're supposed to make an extraordinary gesture, and then the other side says, no, 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 I would never take your daughters. Instead, you know, give us one of the guys. And then Lot has to say something else. That's what he thinks is going on here. Now that also, if you believe that, it exonerates Lot. But who knows? On the face of it, it's still, you know, it's hard to make Lot come out looking good. And remember, we've already seen with the dividing up the land with Abraham that Lot is no picnic, that he's not such a wonderful guy. Okay, so, and said, I beg you, my friends, do not commit this wrong. Look, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Let me bring them out to you, and you may do as you please. But don't do anything to these men, because they've come under the shelter of my roof. But they said, stand back. The fellow, they said, came here as an alien, and already he acts the ruler. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. And they pressed hard against the person of Lot and moved forward to break the door. So, this is also a tight community, the community of Sodom. And they don't like the idea that someone came in and is telling them what to do. Right? Who is Lot to announce to them that they can't have his, his guests? And in fact, what the way the Hebrew has it, it says, Balagur, he came to live, V'yishpot shafot ata, and he's judging a judgment now. Remember what Abraham says to God? Will the judge of all the earth, shofet, the same word, ha-shofet kol ha'aretz lo ya'aseh mishpat, right? Will the judge of all the earth not do justice? And now they're saying, you're judging justice. The same echo. And I think part of this is an attempt to make it clear to us that there is no justice in Sodom whatsoever. None. God is destroying a place that is absolute and total chaos and evil. Yeah. Okay, that's an interesting question. Did he offer his daughters because a homosexual relationship was worse? I don't know in the ancient Near East. In Roman and Greek society, there wasn't the same distinction between homosexual and heterosexual sex. I mean, homosexuality is in part, as far as we know, this sounds weird. It's partly a social category. Some societies, for example, classified sex as penetrator and penetrated without making a distinction, male or female. So I don't know if it was considered worse. I think that you may be right. The more my initial assumption was that Lot just cares more about male visitors than about female daughters. I think that's the way most moderns would read the story, just if you came to it from nothing. It may not be true, I don't know. It may be that he thinks this is a lesser humiliation or a lesser punishment, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. Yeah.
Considering what Lot's daughters do, is it possible that...
Later on, you mean?
Yes.
Right, later on they have sex with their father. Well, so I don't know. That's an interesting question. We to jump ahead in order to evaluate their character here. Later on, they have sex with their father, Lot's daughters. But in mitigation, they think that the world was destroyed, and this is the only man left, and the only way to repopulate the world is to have sex with their father. So, you know, it's not a pretty picture any way you look at it, but... I suppose if you read back, you could read back that Lot thinks that, although that they're corrupt, although he does explicitly say they've never known a man. So.
But there's all kinds of character corruption.
There is all kinds of character corruption. It is possible. I don't know.
There is one more thing that you touched on about this hospitality come down.
Right. Yes.
Came into Spain, you admire something, you are given it. I mean, there is something in Spanish that says, you know, mi casa es tu casa.
Right.
In other words, everything I have is yours. So this is definitely a Middle Eastern tradition. Very strong in our day.
Yeah, I think that the hospitality thing is very powerful. It is still true. I mean, you still go to Bedouin, for example, and Bedouin tents, things like that, you feel that. But with all that, it's impossible to know in some ways because we don't know what the customs were of the time. But it seems from the tone of what the way the Bible presents it that Lot is an unadmirable character, and that's part of what makes it seem as though what he's doing is also, you know. It's just, I don't know. I don't know. You know, in the story that I read you from Judges, it doesn't seem that they're condemning the husband, only the crowd. So it's hard to say. I don't know what a contemporary reader would think of what Lot does. But we're allowed to have our own judgments, so... Yeah, although that's not, they might feel that, although that's not what we've seen so far. I mean, Sara clearly is valued, you know. But in Sodom, they might feel that way, right? And Lot might have picked up that value system.
Well, it's clear that Lot picked up right. The value system because he calls them his friends.
He calls who his friends?
The
people of Sodom. Yeah, right. Yeah, he does. Let's see what the... Right, he says... Yeah, he does. Achai, which really means my brothers. So, my brothers are my friends. Although, yeah, that also could just be the smart rhetorical move. You don't want to say, listen, you jerks. Right? So, okay. However, you will be pleased to know that Lot's daughters do not suffer the same fate as the concubine in the book of Shoftim, in the book of Judges. It's verse 10. But the men stretched out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them. This is very hard to visualize, by the way. A huge crowd outside the house. How do you open the door and pull someone in and shut the door? I can't, you know, it's just hard to imagine.
Why are they called the men in the house?
They're called men all through this. After the first angel thing, they're called men. And it's the same with Abraham, the interplay between men and angel. I mean, we had a brief discussion about it before, but it's not entirely clear. Clearly, I think they take the shape of men. And the people who were at the entrance of the house, young and old, were struck with a blinding light, so they were helpless to find the entrance. Okay, so this is... what does it mean that they were struck with a blinding light? First of all, the idea that the way that they're debilitated is by showing them light is a very symbolic idea, obviously, right? They can't stand to see light. They're like creatures of darkness. And you shine light on them, and they go blind. Also, there's something supernatural about it, because even if right now all of us were blinded, guess what? We'd find the entrance without too much trouble. You know, I mean, how hard would it be to find the door to this room? And they're all crowded around the door. So there's some kind of confusion, apparently, that goes with this blindingness, or they would be able to find the door because they're all right there. And this, I think, this is the first signal to Lot that we know of that these aren't just men, that there's something supernatural going on here. And even though he doesn't exactly acknowledge it, what he does do is listen to what they tell him to do. They just went from being guests to being in charge of the situation. Yeah.
Just back up the sentence and address the pressed heart against the person of Lot. Is that just mean jostling him against the door?
Yeah, I think they're trying to break in the door.
It's not an attacking of him?
All it says, one second, in the Hebrew, vayifritzu ba'ish, vayifritzu is, could be pressing, could be breaking. I mean, yeah, it could be an attack, but it says they want to break the door. So Lot is right in front of the door. I mean, attacking, pushing him out of the way, why? What's the follow-up? I don't know. I mean, it's clear that they want to get Lot too after they say to him, you know, you're not the boss of us, basically. Right. Isn't that more or less what they say?
Yeah. Metaphorically, I don't know the Hebrew, but I'm thinking metaphorically, these angels are bringing light to them. And
yes.
Could be taken as enlightening, but it becomes light.
Right.
It
depends when you think the choice happened. The choice could have happened at that moment, or the choice could have happened long before, in which case they were no longer capable of, you know. But I think the purpose of the whole scene is to show us the character of the people of Sodom. Because if you just have them say, Sodom is a bad city, God's going to destroy it, and then it gets destroyed, you wonder, you know, how bad could it really be? But here, when it's everybody, young and old, all the people of the city, and they want to do such a horrible thing, you get a much more vivid sense that this was an unredeemable place. Yeah.
They don't say women and children. They say
no. Well, they say children, but men, young and old. So the young ones are presumably children. But they don't say the women. No. Right. They do not. So I can tell you, it says Minar Ve'ad Zaken, which means from youth to age, not infants, but youth. And sometimes Na'ar is used for a child, because when Moses is put in the basket and Pharaoh's daughter comes down, it says Vehine Na'ar Bocheh, and behold a child crying, and Moses is an infant, so the same word is used. Although there's a really nice interpretation of that, when it says, because there's a problem with that verse, so as long as we're on it, it says, Vihine, and behold, a child crying. And they said, how is it that she saw instead of heard a child crying? So one interpretation is that Moses cried silently. He was afraid to cry out loud. She just saw him crying. But another one is that a Na'ar, since it usually means a young man, was really Aaron. And Aaron was standing off to the side. And when he saw that his brother was going to be taken away by Pharaoh's daughter and they wouldn't grow up together, he started to cry, which is really nice, you know. Okay, so they're blind, they can't find the entrance, and The men said to Lot, "Whom else have you here? Sons-in-law, your sons, your daughters, anyone else that you have in the city, bring them out of the place, for we're about to destroy this place, because the outcry against them before the Lord has become so great that the Lord has sent us to destroy it." This actually, you know, this raises a question that I'd never thought of before, which is, who cried out to God about the injustice? If the people who cried out about the injustice were innocent, then there are innocents in the city. And if the outcry is so great, a lot of people must have cried out, no? So I can only think of two possibilities. I mean, I've never thought of this before. I'm sure some commentator deals with it, but I haven't seen it. One is that everybody who suffered in the city is either dead or gone, or the people who suffered in the city were themselves wicked, but they cried out when they were put upon by other wicked people, which is, you know, yeah. They were prison lawyers. That's possible. People who are like these angels who pass through Sodom. That's a possibility. And then they leave the city and they cry out about what happened to them when they were in that city. I like that answer. That's a good answer. That may be. So, because, I mean, it's not just that he doesn't find 10 righteous people. As far as we can see, God can't find anyone who's really righteous. So he saves Lot's family as sort of the designated salvation, but everybody else goes down in flames. I have no idea, is the answer. Cities, remember, cities were much, much smaller than we think of. I mean, you know, at like the peak of the Roman Empire, there were 1 million people in Rome or something like that. I mean, that's at the peak, at the biggest. So Jews, when they were 2 million, were like 10% of the Roman Empire, or 3 million, I think 2 million. So we're probably talking about a city of 10,000, 15,000, maybe 20,000. I mean, that's one of the joys and shocks of visiting Israel, is when they say, this is where this great battle took place. You know, and it's the size of Cone Chapel. And you think, oh my God, this was the great battle. But we're talking about very short, and that's also one of the things in modern political terms that is so shocking about going to Israel, is when you say, oh, do you see that coffee over there? It's in Jordan. You know, and you can't believe that it's actually right there, because in a place like America, the distances are so vast that borders are almost imaginary. We don't really think of them as real. So I'm assuming it was a small city, but I don't know how small. And there were 5 cities. Remember, the Sodom and Amorah, and there are 3 other cities that are named in the list, but we only think of Sodom and Amorah. Tzoar being one of them. Okay. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law who had married his daughters and said, "Up, get out of this place, for the Lord is about to destroy the city." But he seemed to his sons-in-law as one who jests. Okay? By the way, the root there is kmitzachek, just like Yitzchak, right? Didn't take it seriously. Yes?
All of a sudden we have sons-in-laws, yet right. They were...
Those two daughters, but presumably he had 2 other daughters.
2 other daughters.
Because the 2 daughters who are married perish in the city, and the other 2 escape with him. So Lot had 4 daughters.
Yeah. As far as the outcry so great before the Lord, it has to be, in Hebrew it says etonet, so isn't that like the name?
Yes, in the face of God.
In the face of God, so yep. You assume they've died.
You assume what?
You would assume that these victims have
died. Not necessarily, because there are things in the face of God that are still in this world.
Okay, so my second
It means it's a way of saying before God.
Okay. My second question though then is, does anybody address the issue of why it takes such a large number of people before God responds? Why does it take such a large number of people to have an outcry before God responds? Why is it not one person being harmed that causes a response from God?
The question was, why does it take such a large number of people? First of all, it doesn't mean, the pious answer would be, it doesn't mean that God hasn't responded to individual cases. It just means that God hasn't condemned the whole city until the whole city is proved. The other answer is, this question is a question that isn't so much discussed here, but is discussed a great deal in the question of slavery. Because Jews are slaves in Egypt for a couple hundred years before the outcry reaches God. And the question there is, why does it take hundreds of years of slavery before God finally responds? And, you know, we could spend a long time on theories about why that is, but it's a question, it takes you back to the question of evil in general, which is, why doesn't God correct every evil at every moment that the evil is committed? And the only, I mean, I won't say the only, there are lots and lots of answers to that question, but the answer that at least seems to me worth considering and thinking about is the, imagine for a minute that in fact, every time something bad happened, God responded. Every time you stole, you got a disease. Every time you hurt someone, you lost money. Then what would happen is you would have a world in which people would never do anything bad, because you know you can't avoid God's punishment, but their being good would have no moral content. It would just be, God always responds, so you better not do anything bad. It would be like, you know, when you say to a child, if you do that, I'll hit you, and the kid doesn't do it, you don't say good kid. You say smart kid, maybe, but not good kid. So it may be that God's response has to be uneven, because that's the only way that people can make moral choices.
There's power in helplessness, because when I'm helpless and I can't help myself, nobody else can help me. God's strength can.
Well, there, right. You point out that there's a different kind of help that God brings as opposed to direct help, but there is also the question of those who have been unable to help themselves, anything from slavery in Egypt to the Holocaust, why God doesn't answer sooner, and that's a hard question that we won't.
What I'm really trying to say, though, is that when someone intended to was evil, and we are helpless over another person's behavior, God can turn that around.
Okay. Can is different from does, though. Yeah. The can here, obviously, is that God is going to destroy the city. I'm just wondering whether we really have time to get to the destruction. Yes. I can. Sorry, Quinn. Right. It also means, right, it also means destruction as well as slaughtering, right, shchita.
Yeah.
A kosher way to destroy it. I like that. I like that. That's a nice idea, right. All the niceties have been observed. This is, you know, I mean, there is also, obviously, there is an analogy, and you'll see the analogy more, actually, with incest between Lot and Noah, as the survivor with a small family of a wholesale destruction. And it does raise the question again of why, in a way, God keeps getting it wrong. You know, God builds a world, puts Adam and Eve in, that doesn't work. It doesn't work with the generation of Noah. It doesn't work with the generation of the Tower of Babel. Now he's trying with Abraham, and Abraham's closest kin goes off to the city of Sodom, where everybody is rotten, and it's like, you know, yeah.
Well, the religious belief that Moshiach is coming and the religious people stays and the bad people destroy, would this happen again?
Well, that's a really interesting question. The question was about Moshiach. Is there this belief that when the Moshiach comes, all the bad people get destroyed again? So there are a lot, the short answer is there are lots of different conceptions of what the Messiah means in the Jewish tradition. For example, early on here in the Bible, there is no discussion of the Messiah whatsoever. I mean, that's a later development. Moshiach in the Bible itself, in the early part of the Bible, until you get to much later on in the prophets, Moshiach just means anointed with oil, and a king is called the Mashiach, right? Because that's what it means, you're anointed with oil. Later on, when the idea develops and the idea of what's going to happen in the Messianic age, so, for example, in the 12th chapter of Daniel, it says that the righteous will arise to everlasting life. which makes it sound like those who aren't righteous just aren't getting up. And there's a, but there are other visions that are much more like what you said, apocalyptic, where the bad people all get destroyed and the good people all get saved. There are visions like Maimonides, which is much more everyday-ish. You know, Maimonides says when it says the lion will lay down with the lamb, it doesn't literally mean that lions will lay down with lambs. It means big nations and small nations will get along without war. That's what it, but that's Maimonides. Other people think it's more literal, you know? And then you know Woody Allen's line, that the lion may lay down with the lamb, but one of them won't get much sleep. So. Yes. So
this really went on a lot. It goes on a lot.
Right.
With orgies and with a whole Dionysian dancing and singing and partying and taking what you want.
This is a question about the question about how much sex has to do with power as opposed to do purely with sex. And there clearly is here. I think that there's no question about it. It's not that all these people are gathering around Lot's house because they feel sexually deprived. They're gathering around Lot's house because they want to assert their, and they want to be cruel, and they want to be powerful, and they want to show, among other things, they clearly want to show Lot, you don't have any power in this city, and we can do whatever we want. And I think that in this may go back to what we were saying before, to take someone's guest out of their house is in some ways even more an assertion of power than to take the daughter out of their house, because the guest, the whole point of having a guest is to protect them. That's the whole point. And when you say you can't protect your guest, you're saying you're completely powerless before us. So that may be, yeah.
You were just talking about wondering why God doesn't give advice, but is it possible that only the sensational stories found their way in the Bible, because that's what gets read, that's why the National Enquirer.
Right.
About
what God did for people. There is something to that. I like that idea that you only report the bad news. Even in the Bible, you only report the bad news. One of the reasons why I read the story in Judges is because I think people don't realize how full of life, good and bad, the Bible really is. It has some very powerful stories of all sorts. I think that it is certainly true that in every person's day, much less every society, there are more stories that happen than you could possibly tell. So the selection of stories is clearly designed to make a point. And every story, you have to wonder what the point is. And through it all, it's fair to constantly ask yourself, what's the character of God? What do these stories tell us about God? And I would say that the story of Sodom, one of the ways of maybe answering that question and one of the ways of interpreting the story of Sodom is what it tells us about God is God actually gives you a chance to correct the ills of your society before God does it for you. Sodom had time before it became so completely irredeemable that God couldn't do it. And we talked before about the fact that the Bible, by and large, the Bible speaks of something that we don't like to think about anymore, which is group justice as opposed to individual justice. And the truth is that group justice is the way we live, even though we don't like it. Yeah.
I'm very interested in this concept of the children sinners. I mean, obviously, you're talking about the adults who are culpable for their actions. That's understandable. I mean, my understanding of Jewish tradition, especially when on Bar Mitzvah, is that at a certain age, you assume, you know, culpability or responsibility for your actions. But as a child, the accountability for your actions is, you know, upon your parents.
That's true. But then the question is, could God have wiped out an entire city of adults and left an entire city of children who've been raised to cruelty to live in the world? Which is a question worth asking. But, yeah. And this, again, goes to...
I mean, as a child,
they are definitionally innocent, but that doesn't mean that they will therefore escape what happens to the entire community. Just as when it says that children will be punished for the sins of their parents in the Bible, which it does, the answer that the rabbis give is that's not because they deserve it, but that's because the way the world is. The sins that your parents commit, you in fact pay for it. It may not be just, you didn't do them, but and so let me close with a line from Jung. Since we've done a lot of Bible today, one of his wisest sayings, that's Carl Jung, the morally questionable psychoanalyst, who was no friend of the Jews, let me just say, among other things. But that doesn't make him unwise. It just makes him immoral. So he said the greatest influence on children is the unlived lives of their parents. In other words, the things that you didn't do, the things that you always wanted to do, the things that you think you should have done better, that's what becomes the greatest influence on your child. Now, is that fair? Is it fair that I would push my daughter to, I don't know, be, I mean, this is not a good example because it's not true, but is it fair that I would push my daughter to take 20 years of piano lessons because I always wanted to be a concert pianist, even though she has no interest? No, it's not fair. But that, it's the same thing with that as with group justice. I mean, when you bomb a country because its leaders do something, is that fair? No, it's not fair. But we are bound up in community. And when in America, which we try to do, we isolate individuals and say, but this person was innocent, the true, if it's unsatisfactory answer is the world doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. And we are all implicated in what all the rest of us do. Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.